Good evening. This is Ray Hill. You're listening to radio station KPFT HD2 channel. This is our regular Texas Execution Watch programming. Every time someone is executed in Texas, we will take this channel and this occasion to talk about that case and executions in general. It is an obligation of Pacifica Foundation radio station KPFT. We happen to be the radio station in Texas, and you can hear us on the KPFT HD2, as well as you can hear us on the internet over kpft.org. That word has gotten around today, so I suspect we're have a little larger audience than we have.
BBC News with Mary Small. The authorities in the United States say that 11 people have been charged in connection with the theft of the credit and debit card details of millions of people. They say it's the biggest identity theft case ever prosecuted in the U.S. Those charged include residents of at least five different countries. Kevin Connolly reports from Washington.
Credit and debit card records of 40 million customers were stolen by members of a sophisticated international gang who hacked into the computers of the TJX Corporation.
And they were,
it operates 2,000 shops, including Barnes & Noble bookstores and the clothing chain TJ Maxx. The 11 people who will be appearing in court include three Americans, two people from China, and five from the former Soviet Union.
With that, Gloria, are you there?
How many of the 40 million customers whose
details
were stolen?
Could you tell us what's going on there?
But it's known that the gang used some card numbers themselves and sold some on to other criminal gangs.
The government of Rwanda has accused France of playing an active role in the genocide of 1994, in which about 800,000 people were killed. A two-year investigation commissioned by the authorities in Kigali concluded that France helped plan the genocide and accused French troops of direct involvement in the killings. France has previously denied any responsibility for the Rwanda genocide. Iran has suspended the practice of stoning people to death. Four people have had their sentence changed, and all other cases are under review. The move was announced by the judiciary spokesman in Tehran. From the Iranian capital, here's John Lyne.
Human rights campaigners recently warned that at least eight women and one man had been sentenced to be stoned to death, and all had exhausted their appeals. The judiciary spokesman has now said that four of those facing stoning have had their sentences commuted, either to prison terms or they would receive lashes.
The Supreme Court is still looking
all other sentences of stoning to death have been halted while the cases are reviewed. Iran is well aware of international pressure on this issue, but it's been reluctant completely to abolish a penalty it says is endorsed under Islamic law.
Pakistani woman who is alleged to have close links to Al-Qaeda's leadership has appeared in court in New York charged with attempting to kill American soldiers in Afghanistan last month. Lawyers for the woman, Afia Siddiqui, say she's been held in secret U.S. detention after disappearing 5 years ago on a trip from the U.S. to Pakistan along with her children. The court documents indicate that she was only arrested last month in eastern Afghanistan, where it's alleged she tried to shoot an American.
Well, since today is the day we had a hurricane come through, since today was the day we had weather, what's the weather like there?
Well, it was raining horribly on the way up here.
For the family. But we are very concerned about
it's let up.
Our
it's actually not raining at all right now.
Okay, so you're in an endurable situation. I'll tell you what. Gloria, you go to these things regularly. Have you ever seen this much interest by media in recent years?
Mexican man.
Not recently. It's been a while.
The man, José Ernesto Medellin, was convicted in 1993 of the rape and murder of two teenagers. Mr. Medellin alleged that he had not been allowed to consult the Mexican consulate for legal help after he was arrested.
The one guy from
the White House in
Press
Washington and the Central
here.
Intelligence
Tonight,
Agency have strongly
here,
denied an allegation in a book just published
that
the Bush administration could
now, doesn't he usually go in?
To show a link between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda as a justification for the Iraq war.
We're still waiting.
White House
Nobody
spokesman Tony Fratto said the notion that the White House directed anyone to forge a letter was absurd.
Well, for the sake of our folks who can't quite visualize it, you've got a bunch of cameras sitting out in the street to cover the external part of the event, and the media representatives will not have cameras, and they will go as a group. They will not have cameras, and they will go as a group from the public information office into the prison, right?
The European Commission now wants to give the technology a boost in Europe by reserving a chunk of radio bandwidth across the 27 EU member states. That allows manufacturers to put the technology in new cars, knowing it can be applied across a huge market. But as well as transmissions from a central traffic control center, the technology might also allow cars to communicate with each other.
I hear somebody on the sound system speaking.
It could inform nearby cars.
Clashes between police and opposition protesters in southern Bolivia have led to the cancellation of a meeting between the leader, Evo Morales, and his Venezuelan and Argentine counterparts.
Well, we can't say that, but nobody's listening on
this. Cristina Fernandez have been due to fly to Argentina to discuss energy contracts, but called the visit off when protesters attempted to storm the runway.
Oh,
BBC
my God.
News.
No, the media is not going across the street. Something has happened.
They're holding a press conference out on the sidewalk? Gloria, I'm familiar with the territory. They're holding a conference out on the porch?
Well, it looked like it, but now the media has gone back. Let me see who these people are. The media has gone back to their positions with their cameras. What happened?
And we have
two Latino-looking men are talking to a cameraman. I'm not sure.
Okay. Well, this is almost too important to leave you. So
well, now they're all walking back up the hill. So I don't know.
They're all walking back up the hill.
Yeah. Have you heard anything? There's a CNN camera woman right here.
Okay.
She hasn't heard anything. Excuse me. What do you know? What's happened? No. Okay.
Okay, so we don't know what's developing.
No, we don't know. All we know is the group of media witnesses has not yet crossed the street.
There has not been the march across the street of the media witnesses. Okay, Gloria, I am. You want to hang on, or you want us to call you back?
I can hang on or whatever.
Okay, well, you hang on. If something happens, just holler. I'll be able to hear you on backline.
Okay.
Okay?
All right.
Well, there's developments. And I've got a couple of folks here with me. Number one, could you get close enough to the microphone? You can't look at me and talk. You have to look at that microphone and talk. And tell me who you are.
My name's Billy Sinclair.
Billy Sinclair. And Billy Sinclair is a former death row inmate from Louisiana.
That's right.
And he did time in Louisiana prison after getting removed from death row.
Yes. I was one of the pre-Furman inmates and spent 6 years, 6.5 years on death row before having my sentence commuted as a result of Furman, and spent a total of 40 years in the state prison system before being paroled to Texas in 2006.
Now you have followed this case of late.
Yes, I have.
Tell us about it.
Well, I work for a John T. Floyd law firm here in Houston, a criminal defense attorney. And we post frequent articles on his website, and this is one of the cases that we have followed. And I've written a number of articles about Medellin.
Okay, and what have you learned about this case?
I think this case goes beyond the normal death penalty case because of the international implications. The Medellin case has raised what international legal obligations the United States has toward other countries. And in 1969, the United States ratified the Geneva
Accords?
No, it was the Geneva Convention. And in that convention, they spelled out that there would be certain rights given to individuals arrested in foreign countries. One of the rights that were spelled out in that convention was the fact that that people arrested in foreign countries have a right to contact their embassy, their counselor, who could then provide certain kinds of assistance, including getting an attorney. And in this case, and what's happened in a number of Mexican national cases, you had inmates who are people who were arrested in this country, and after they became part of the, this nation's criminal justice system, it was learned, like in Medellin's case, that they had not been properly advised of their consular rights. And
but this is not by any means an exceptional case.
No, I don't think it's.
There are numerous cases of this kind, and not just for Mexican nationals, but people of other nationalities.
Yes, but I think this case is highlighted by the fact that the International Court of Justice in 2004 handed down what's known as the Avena decision, which in effect said that 51 Mexican nationals who had been denied their consular rights were entitled to a review of their convictions and sentences in this country. And those 51 Mexican nationals are some are housed on death row and some are housed in prisons in the United States. And so that's become the core issue. And it was made even more dramatic when in 2005 President Bush issued a memorandum to the Attorney General of the United States saying, in effect, that the Avena decision would have was applicable as federal law and binding on the state and federal courts in this country. And that created a substantial uproar, political uproar, in the state of Texas, because the state of Texas felt like they were being dictated to by the International Court of Justice, and it, President Bush had gotten involved in this controversy by making the Avena decision applicable to the state of Texas and other states. And so it prompted a series of appeals back through the state courts and the federal courts and ended up for the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court in May handed down a decision that while the ICJ decision had certain international law obligations attached to it, that it did not automatically create a federal law that was binding on state or federal courts in this country, particularly concerning the consular rights issue.
Any of this law been tested? I mean, has the Supreme Court looked at this issue?
Well, yeah, they've looked at it a couple times. In fact, in an Oregon case in 2005, I believe it was, the Supreme Court, in effect, ruled against a Mexican national inmate by saying, in effect, that the ICJ decisions were not binding on courts in this country. And then once the president got involved and said, but it does, that the United States have certain international treaty obligations with the international community, it prompted sort of a legal crisis, a constitutional crisis, where the president has suddenly injected himself into the controversy and said, hold it, we're bound by this decision.
Well,
and
what is the implications for Americans in other countries who were denied consular negotiated at least discussions prior to trial and conviction?
I don't think anyone will yet know, and probably won't know for some time, exactly what the long-term impact of, if Medellin is executed, what impact that will have on Americans arrested in other countries. But I'm sure that there have been Americans who have been arrested in foreign countries, and particularly some of the underdeveloped countries, mm-hmm. who requested counsel or who made some kind of effort to secure legal assistance through the embassy, and those requests were ignored. So I don't think that is a new phenomenon. I think that has happened with every citizen arrested in a foreign country where their rights have not been truly respected.
Well, we also have Jim Skelton in with us. And, Jim, can you pull the microphone over? And, Jim, you were telling me before the show that one state has recognized the Avena decision.
Yeah, before I get into that, let me do some clarification. First off, a lot of folks don't know what the World Court is, the International Court of Justice. What happened when they formed the League of Nations back in the 1920s? They had an international court as a part of the League of Nations. Then when the UN came into effect at the end of World War II, they developed the International Court of Justice that sits at The Hague. And what it basically is, it's designed to handle disputes between states, is what it's primarily designed to do. And what happened prior to the International Court being set up, they had the Vienna Consular, they had called it the Vienna Convention on Consular Relations. What it basically says is not quite as broad as people said. What it basically says is that when a citizen from a foreign country is arrested, that the arresting officials have the obligation to advise him that he has a right to see his local counselor. the local embassy or consul if they got a consul. It doesn't say what they're, if he invokes that right, whether they're supposed to stop questioning. They just simply say they have, they're supposed to advise him.
It doesn't say
right.
What happens.
Exactly.
Right.
Like in the Edwards decision or some of the decisions about right to counsel, when you invoke your right to counsel, they got to shut up. But in this particular case, all they got to do is advise him of his right to see his consul. And it doesn't say what to happen. And then if he wants to see his consul at that point, they say they're to notify the consul either by fax or let him know that he's arrested.
Well, Jim, that doesn't sound like an unreasonable burden.
No.
Why is there so much difficulty following it?
Well, nobody knew it existed, because here's the problem in this case, truthfully. And I'm not sure this is a place to draw your battleground, because Medellin was 3 years old when he moved to this country. He was 18 years old when this occurred. 15 of his 18 years he lived here in the States. And when he was arrested, and contrary to what a lot of folks have said, when he was arrested, he told the police when he gave his confession that he was born in Mexico. And I don't think anybody in the legal profession is even aware of the fact that we have this Vienna Agreement on Consular Relations. They didn't tell him
that. It's not a popular subject in various kind of criminal defense lawyers meet.
Nobody would. I don't think anybody knew it. And I'm not sure he even knew it, because it wasn't until 4 years later this issue was brought up. That's the problem. Because this is not a typical deal where you have a citizen of Mexico visiting this country charged with a crime. You had somebody that moved over here when he was 3 years of age. Spent 15 of his 18 years.
Wait a minute, we have a breaking issue. Gloria, I've just turned up your microphone. Now, what's going on?
Okay, hang on. Well, I'm trying to tell the crowd. According to the Chronicle, the execution is on hold because the Supreme Court is still considering the appeal. So at this point, the media witnesses have not gone across the street. Nothing is happening because the Supreme Court has not ruled yet. This is according to the Houston Chronicle's website. Did you hear that?
Yes, I just heard that, and thank you very much for that update. If anything else happened, make an announcement in a loud voice, and we'll turn you back on.
Okay.
All right,
thanks.
We've got Gloria up there, the unsuspecting reporter. The word from the Houston Chronicle website is that the United States Supreme Court is still considering the issue raised. I presume we're talking about this very treaty issue.
Well, there was a recent, like the Court of Criminal Appeals on the 31st had another hearing in which they denied a third writ, and that may be the way they're appealing. Plus, the International Court issued another explanation of the Vienna decision that came out, I believe, on the 22nd of July, the 22nd of this past month. And that may be what they're trying to consider. That may very well be it, because the Court of Criminal Appeals just denied a third writ of habeas corpus.
Well, that would not, nothing in his would vacate that sentence.
If.
Go ahead.
I wanted to add one thing, but to elaborate on what Jim was saying, is that of the 171 nations that, and this is one of the things that the Supreme Court brought out, of the 171 nations that adopted and ratified the Vienna Convention, none of them make the ICJ's decisions binding on their domestic courts. So this is a whole new area here. I don't know if any other country has gone through the kind of political turmoil that we have in the Medellin case. But none of these other 171 nations accept ICJ decisions as binding on their domestic courts. And one of the problems you have here is that when the member nations have a dispute concerning the Vienna Convention, they have an optional protocol which resolves these disputes. But when they created the optional protocol, there was no enforcement mechanism that was tied into the optional protocol for how to enforce when a dispute resolution was reached between the member nations. How did you enforce the decision? Like in this case, the ICJ made the decision, then the Avena decision. But there's no enforcement mechanism available to say this is what the member nations should do. So that's the problem that's inherent in this Medellin case, that even the ICJ's decision has no way of really being enforced. And I think that is why, and I'm only speculating here, I think that is why that perhaps Bush in 2005 decided to issue his memorandum to the Attorney General to try to bring the matter to a head where the United States Supreme Court ruled.
Doesn't the Bush administration have problems with this court anyway? Isn't there some problems about recognizing the International Court of Justice? certainly as far as American military personnel is concerned.
I think there has been some problems with the United States and the whole, all of our international obligations and our international treaty affiliations and everything else. But I think in this case that in 2005 when Bush issued a memorandum, I think that that was done more because he knew, instinctively knew, because he appointed two of the most conservative members to the Supreme Court, which way the Supreme Court would come down decision. So I think that he had he was able to have his cake and eat it too. He was able to issue his memorandum to the Attorney General saying that the ICJ decision was binding on federal and state courts in America, and that allowed the United States to look like it was at least adhering to its treaty obligations, knowing that the case would eventually work its way to the United States Supreme Court, and that the United States Supreme Court would rule as it did in this year and reject the whole notion of it.
I've got a couple of more questions, but Gloria?
Yes.
Why don't we do this? Why don't you keep your eyes open, your ears open, and I'm going to hang up on you, save your battery power. And if anything happens, call Elizabeth, and we'll get right back in touch with you.
Okay, I'll do that.
Thank you.
It looks like we're just really at a standoff here. People, the media is kind of relaxed and chatting, and some of them are sitting.
Well, we will cope with that and be back to you if anything happens.
Okay.
Okay.
Thanks.
And when we say we will cope with that, is there a timeline here, Jim?
No timeline at all. Supreme Court does pretty much as they
do. No, I'm not talking about the Supreme Court. I mean, is there a point at which they can't execute in Texas?
Only if there is a stay granted.
So they could do this at 6 o'clock in the morning?
Sure.
I mean, in the old days, it was from midnight to sunup. I remember one guy was about to be executed, and they were afraid he was going to filibuster until sunup.
You're make it
so the
less
chaplain held him down while they injected him, but in order to hurry the process up. I mean, he had to be a man of few words, or he was going to live. Do you remember anything about complaints by conservatives close to this administration about the International Court of Justice?
The problem is real simple. The International Court of Justice, there's a magic word that lawyers use called comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, and what that basically means, and that's what Bush said. He didn't tell the Attorney General to tell the states to abide. He asked them to do so. Comity literally means courtesy. And what this basically means, the International Court of Justice opinions can be followed if people want to be courteous about it. There's no obligation of the federal government or the state government to follow what the International Court says because they have no authority to enforce it. It's just they can do it by, in fact, that's exactly what Bush said in his memorandum. He said that then what the Avena decision basically said is that, well, first of all, let's go back a second. When the Court of Criminal Appeals first brought up the issue about the being a conventional counsel relations, they basically said that a person didn't have individual rights. This was a treaty right between countries, mm-hmm. and that it didn't invest individuals with specific rights. The International Court, when they issued the Avena decision, said to the contrary that it did bestow individual rights upon mm-hmm. citizens. And what they asked different governments to do is to review everybody who did was a foreign national who had been not advised under the Vienna account under the Vienna Convention, to advise, had not been advised of their consular rights, for them to review those cases and to see whether or not they had been prejudiced by not being advised that they could write their right to see their local consul. And that's what they asked them to do. And what this Bush did after that decision came out, Bush talked to the Attorney General, and what he said, that he asked the states to do the same thing under the concept of comity, C-O-M-I-T-Y, which means they could or could not follow it. For example, Texas doesn't have to follow laws or things by Louisiana unless they just want to do it, unless they want to be polite about
sure.
it. It's a jurisdictional problem, and this is what basically they said. And what happened, the Supreme Court at that time had the case on appeal, and they simply dismissed the case to let the state courts decide. And the Texas came back kind of rocking and rolling. They said, number one, Bush hasn't got authority to do that. And here is the real, real problem. There's a problem with jurisdiction because in state courts, and this is true of every court in this nation, You have got to raise an error at the trial level to preserve appeal as a general rule.
And that's kind of part of expedient executions. And
well, that's a part of our jurisprudence. In fact, there are three type of errors they talk about. You have fundamental errors or structural errors that cannot be waived. And they said that the rights under the consulate was not one of those fundamental errors. And you have waivable rights. For example, right to a trial by jury, you got to actually waive it. In order for you to, you've got to waive it. And then you have those rights that need not be waived. And that's what they said this right was under Avena, that since he did not bring it up at the trial level, he waived the right to bring it up on appeal. And that's exactly where the big problem came in. They said that he didn't bring it up till 4 years after his conviction, and they said he waived his right to bring that up.
Would this be a simpler or a more complicated matter if this were a United States court case?
Federal court?
Yeah.
No. Because, in fact, what the U.S. Supreme Court said, they said Bush exceeded his authority, that we have, you know, our country can abide by the laws that Congress passes, and they said he has no right to order the federal courts to do that. In fact, what they said, there's two solutions to this, what the Supreme Court said. They can either pass legislation to make a non-self-proving treaty binding upon states if they choose to do so. Either pass that legislation, or Texas, under the concept of comity courtesy, can abide by the decision. And only one state has chosen to do that. That's surprisingly the state of Arkansas. Mm-hmm. It's the only state that's chosen to do that, and they commuted a death sentence to life if that particular defendant gave up his rights under Avena. And there's no requirement that Texas has to follow the International Court of Justice, no requirement federal courts have to follow the International Court of Justice. They can choose to do so if they want to. They don't have to.
Well, I mean, I'm you know, I can be a little ignorant, but a little ignorant, that's an understatement. There's a lot of brouhaha in Huntsville. We've got television cameras from all over Spanish-speaking world there. Apparently, to them, this is an important issue, or their media would not be here in abundance.
It absolutely is an important issue. Our only question is, I'm not sure this is the place that we should fight our fight, because, like I say, this is not one of those traditional things where a foreign citizen is visiting another country and gets accused of a crime. This is somebody, truthfully, who was reared in America, who just didn't bother when he moved over here to get a citizenship. I mean, he's been in the country since he's been 3 years old. And, in fact, there's some mistaken put out in the media. When he gave his confession, he told the officer he'd been born in Mexico, but he never said he didn't seek his citizenship. Mm-hmm. Now, when he went through pretrial services, which is our agency to determine bonds, he told them then he was a Mexican citizen. That was the first time anybody in any type of legal setting knew he was not an American citizen. But pretrial services, according to the Court of Criminal Appeals, is not a part of the prosecution branch, and that didn't inure to the state, didn't give them notice that he was an American citizen, not an American citizen. And frankly, I think if they even knew he was a Mexican citizen, I don't think anybody in Houston was even aware of the fact that a lot of people don't know where Vienna is to begin with in this state. And I'm telling you, the Vienna Convention would be
a close to comfort. I've been through that.
Yes, I'm saying. I'm not sure anybody even knew it existed, because, like I said, it took them 4 years to figure out there may be a problem.
Well, you see, one of the things I think the International Court of Justice anticipated, because in their 2004 decision, when they said that the United States courts should reconsider the convictions and sentences in these 51 Mexican nationals, they also made it clear that that these individuals could not waive or were not procedure defaulted if they hadn't raised these issues to begin with. So they set the stage for the political fallout, for the political confrontation that would ensue, because the states in Texas and the Texas courts and the Texas Attorney General and Texas authorities have all argued, just like Jim pointed out, that this issue wasn't brought up to years after Medellin's arrest and his conviction. So he was procedurally defaulted on raising these issues. And so I think the International Court of Justice anticipated that this would be a primary argument of the states. And so they wanted to get that issue out there and say that the violation of consular rights were so important that they could not be waived, but then they could not be defaulted on simply because they wasn't presented by the inmate or by his attorney. And like Jim said, well, what attorney?
The inmate himself is not an officer of the court, and so his obligations are considerably less than his attorney's.
Well, yeah, but he can, you know, some inmates might be smart enough to know to tell his attorney, hey, I want you to raise this issue. But like Jim said, how many inmates would know that, much less how many attorneys would even know about the Vienna Convention?
Right. They don't know where in Texas Vienna is.
No, so they certainly wouldn't know about the requirements of the Vienna Convention. And most people, even when they're arrested overseas, the only thing that they know if American is arrested in India or arrested in Russia, the only thing they know basically is to call an embassy or to try to get some kind of legal assistance through the embassy. But if a person is in this country, and if he was born in Mexico and lived all his life in this country as an American citizen, as Medellin did, the last thing in his mind, particularly if he's arrested for capital murder and one of the most high-profile crimes in Harris County's history, would know to say, hey, I want to talk to the, I want to exercise my counsel rights and speak to my Mexican counselor. I don't think anybody would know that.
Well, I want to talk to the audience here for a minute. My name is Ray Hill. You're listening to Execution or Texas Execution Watch. We do this every time there is an execution in Texas. You're listening on radio station KPFT HD2. My guest are Mr. Skelton, an attorney in Houston, Mr. Sinclair, a man who has had some experience with death row in prison and is himself a paralegal. On the ground in Huntsville, we have KPFT volunteer Gloria Ruback, who is covering that demonstration up there. And here in the studio, I'm Ray Hill. The whole thing was successfully produced by Elizabeth Stein, who is our producer. And, of course, we have a technical wizard in the person of Otis McClay, who keeps us on the air and gets this channel up and rolling for local programming every time we need it. We're talking about the Medellin case, and we've been spending the first half of this hour trying to find out what is going on in Huntsville, and apparently, according to Gloria's last report, there is a hold on everything going on in Huntsville because the Supreme Court is still considering the issue that we have been discussing, and that is the Vienna Convention. A requirement that people accused of crimes in foreign countries are advised that they can consult with their local counsel from the nation from which they are citizens. That was not invoked in this case. There's some confusion of whether it need have been convoked in this case, and the only statement we have very clear that that doesn't make any difference is from Texas Governor Perry, who says he don't give a devil as long as the execution proceeds. He cares not about foreigners or any treaties with them. And so that's where we are with it. There are a couple of other aspects about this case that concern me. One of them is that this was a heinous crime, the rape and killing of two teenage girls following a kind of gang ritual fight. According to all reports that I have seen, these guys were in an isolated place, path through the woods, and they had been fighting because that's what it took to get membership in their gang. And so you have this adrenaline rush where guys are beating up on one another, and then these two girls come by, and that activity expands into the beating and sexual exploitation and ultimately the killing of those two girls. So this is a product of gangs stuff. And, of course, on the prison show, I frequently talk about gangs. I say gangs are not tough guys hanging together, but cowards being manipulating weak people. And I also have a statement about it that I gave up Captain Midnight and the Secret Decoder Ring when I was about 8 or 9 years old. That kind of gang membership, which is destructive to self and others, is something that that is part of a cultural phenomena that exceeds this case in seriousness, because this can happen in your neighborhood and in my neighborhood, and senseless violence happens as a result of it. There were several people involved. Those that were under the age of 18 when this occurred have been given commuted sentences. They are now doing life because at some point the Supreme Court, they were on death row, but the Supreme Court said, well, you can't execute anybody who committed a crime under 18. So a couple of his gang members were given lesser sentences and are now in general population in Texas prison system somewhere other than death row. Has one other person been executed in this case?
Sean O'Brien
was already been executed. Right. So Medellin is the second up, and is there a remaining?
Yeah, Peter Cantu is remaining.
Okay. And so this is now Peter Cantu and Sean O'Brien, I take it, are American citizens.
Yes.
So this treaty is not an issue in their case.
There's a kid named Ephraim Perez and Raul Villarreal were under 18 when the...
And they were commuted.
They were commuted because
the
Supreme
Court... Well, one of them got a lesser sentence in the plea bargain because he gave testimony against the other.
In fact, Ray, this is one of the things that if you read Judge Cochran's decision this past week that came out of the Court of Criminal Appeals, one of the things she pointed out, and one thing all the courts have been yelling about, they said they didn't care if they'd hired every lawyer in America, that a Harris County jury would have executed anybody even within shooting distance of the park. The crime was so bad. And that's one of the things they talk about a whole lot, is that the crime was so heinous that even had he been advised to see his consular, and even had the consular came over, and even had they provided counsel, regardless of what lawyer he would have hired, the crime was so bad that a Harris County jury would have given him the death penalty anyway. And that's one of the things they talked about. My only quarrel with that comment is if a consular had come over, he might not have given a confession, because one of the major, major things that ended up Medellin getting the death penalty, he gave a very graphic confession as to what happened. Mm. And during the course of the confession, showed no remorse about killing the girls. And the confession was pretty detailed about what he had done. Now, assuming that he had been advised of his right to see his counsel, and assuming they would have got a lawyer over there quickly enough, I'm sure a lawyer would have said, shut your mouth. That's the only thing I can say that would have helped him. But the problem is with the consular, this Vienna Convention on Consular Relations, all it says, you tell them he has a right to call his counsel. That's it.
That's it.
It doesn't say that they have to notify the counsel. All they say, if he says, okay, I want to see my counsel, they can send him a fax and say, we got him arrested and this is his name. It doesn't mean they have to stop the questioning.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that was your big problem, because as a general rule, when the police get a hold of somebody like this, you know that as well as I do, when they're questioning.
I've been through it two or three times.
If 50 lawyers go down, they won't let him within 100 yards of him. They won't let him inside the building. And so, assuming they would have called the consul, I'm sure they probably would have had a confession anyway. And the problem is, once he confessed in this graphic detail, I don't care if they'd hired every lawyer in America, at least in what the court seemed to say, is that they would have given him the death penalty. Because everybody involved got the death penalty, except those who plea bargained down for a lesser sentence. Mm-hmm.
Everybody.
And there's no assurance that if he'd had the best lawyers in America, that he wouldn't have gotten the death penalty anyway. The big problem with this whole deal is it doesn't say what you do once the guy says, I'm going to see my counsel. They can apparently say, okay, we'll send them a fax and continue questioning.
Sure.
We don't know. And that's the big problem. I can say it doesn't help a whole lot if they can continue getting confessions from people.
Jim raised one good point about the overwhelming nature of the evidence against Medellin and the other people involved in this crime. And I think that's where the state of Texas has made a serious political blunder, because if they had simply reversed a conviction, Medellin's conviction, and retried him, as Jim pointed out, any jury in Harris County, first trial, second trial, third trial, would return the death penalty in this case. And if he had a trial that satisfied the international community, particularly the Mexican government, and he received the death penalty a second time, then you would simply the United States would be able to say we maintained our obligations to the international legal community, and we respected this man's rights. And at the first trial, they wasn't. And the only issue would be is whether or not the confession he gave, as Jim pointed out, which was so detailed and graphic and incriminating, whether or not it would be admissible in the second trial, and if there was evidence in addition to that confession that could be used to convict a man. But from everything I've read about the case, this was an overwhelming case of guilt. And what did the state of Texas lose in comparison to what's been lost in terms of its standing in the international community? What did the state of Texas gain by taking such a hard-nosed stand in this case, when it would have seemed to me that a new trial and a second trial, a trial that satisfied the international community, and a conviction would have been had, and the same sentence would have been imposed.
This is another case where the survivors of the victims have aggressively pursued this execution.
They have.
And I saw Mr. Ertman and Mr. Pena on television this week basically saying, show no mercy, kill him, kill him, kill him. And I take it that not every case has this kind of activism on the other side.
Ray, let me tell you a problem. Here's one of the problems, and this is just from a lawyer viewpoint. See, the real problem with they trying to reverse this case is that you can't unring a bell. How do you go back and determine whether or not a confession is going to be admitted or not once there's not been some sort of advice given? This is kind of new territory. And I don't know what basis they would have reversed it, because there's a thing that courts rely upon a great deal called a causal connection. And let me give you a couple examples of it. The juvenile code says that when a person is picked up by police and he's a juvenile, they got to immediately notify their parents. And there have been numerous cases come down in which people have been picked up by the police. They didn't need to notify the parents, and the kids gave confessions.
Mm-hmm.
And they've always affirmed those cases, and they didn't reverse it. You know what they said? There's no causal connection between the violation of the family code and the fact he gave a confession. And you have the same thing true. You have a so-called magistrate warning that's required by law. The law says as soon as you're arrested, as soon as it's possible, take them in front of a magistrate and advise them of their rights. Now, what happens oftentimes, someone's arrested, they're not taken in front of a magistrate, their rights are not given their rights, and they still give confessions. And the question is, can you kill that confession because they violated that provision requirement of going in front of a magistrate? And they say the same thing again. There's no causal, you got to show a causal connection, that if you got to be able to demonstrate that had been given a magistrate right, that he would have given the confession. They can't prove a causal connection. And there's only been one case. I remember there's a case out of Smith County where some kid, and this was what's ironical. This is one time being a crook really helped, because in this particular case, they arrested two juveniles who killed a school teacher. And they didn't immediately notify their parents. And what happened, they gave a confession. And they were able to show a causal connection, because in times past, the parents always went to the police station when their kids got arrested, because they got arrested a whole bunch. And they were able to show a pattern that the kid's family always went down there. And see, the problem is there's really no basis to reverse this based upon a violation of that consular right, because, number one, you have to, and this isn't just unique to Texas. This concept of procedural default is ingrained in Anglo-Saxon jurisprudence. It's true of every state court in this nation and of every federal court in this nation. And we're not likely to change that, because the world court said that you should not use procedural default. That's ingrained as a part of our jurisprudence. That isn't likely to change. And number two, there's no basis to reverse the case, because you're going to reverse it and say what? What are you going to have a hearing to determine whether or not the confession is admissible? They're going to say the same thing, that you haven't demonstrated a causal connection. And they did that with the juvenile. They've done that with juvenile cases. They've done that for not giving magistrate warnings. And I don't think there's any realistic chance that they would ever reverse the case, because how would you get around our concept of procedural default that's a part of our jurisprudence? You can't.
The only thing I would add to that, Ray, is one thing, is that I would differ with Jim only in this respect, in a very limited respect, is that you had four justices agree with Medellin's position when he was before the Supreme Court, because it was a 5-4 decision. And apparently now, even after the Supreme Court made its May decision, this case is so controversial that at this last hour, just moments before the man's be put to death, the Supreme Court is still finding some reason, and we don't know what that is because we're not privy to what's going on in chambers of the Supreme Court right now. But there's something that perhaps the four judges who dissented in the case are now strongly reasserting their positions, and perhaps they're trying to, because the only thing they could do is to, in effect, overturn the 5-4 decision, because I don't think there's any other way that they could get in here now after their 5-4 decision saying he wasn't entitled to a hearing or a new trial, is to now get in there and say that some kind of way that he is. But it goes to show how politicized issues become, and that's very unusual, because normally in a case where you have such strong victim opposition, which is manifest in this case with Mr. Pena and Mr. Ertman being so vocal and the community being so outraged by this case, that this is a very rare case where the international politics of the case have somehow risen above the local politics, and we don't know what kind of impact that is, how it's going to yet play out.
Generally speaking, whenever we're before the Supreme Court of the United States, because this is not my first rodeo, it depends on who answered telephone.
Right.
If Scalia answered telephone, we have an execution. If somebody else answered telephone, we may not
maybe
have an execution.
Italian, maybe not.
Right, right. Yeah. Well, if it's an Italian Catholic, maybe even Scalia is the one that's right. But the other thing that's going on is this is still cooking before the Supreme Court of the United States. So that tells me that whoever answered the telephone, number one, thought this issue was important enough to consult other Supreme Court justices. And that's what takes time, because if they could apply the existing laws, they and their clerks could apply the existing laws and rulings, this case would have been decided and the media would have either been dismissed or they would have walked across the street to the execution. But there is some contemplation involving more than one judge here. Is that a reasonable conclusion?
Let me tell you what I think. Let me do some speculating on this. The Court of Criminal Appeals on July the 31st, which was just not long ago, what they basically did, they denied a third writ, and they denied it based upon our provision of their statute that says that when you file one writ, unless there's something new or unique or unusual, all subsequent writs are barred. And that provision is called, it's 1171 section 5. What it basically says is that you can file one bite out of the apple. Mm-hmm. And when you file a writ, you got to throw everything in there, and you can't file a subsequent writ unless it's something that's unique that you didn't anticipate before or you discovered new evidence. And the reason they did that is because they had to fight off a whole series of what we call writ riders who would file writ after writ after writ just to get a stay of execution. And that's why that legislation was passed. Well, this, on July the 31st, our Court of Criminal Appeals, based upon that provision of the statute, denied a subsequent writ to reconsider this and under that particular article. And it could very well be that the Supreme Court is looking at the validity of that particular denial.
Yeah. Okay.
That's all it could be, because you got a Court of Criminal Appeals decision. I'm assuming they grant cert in that Court of Criminal Appeals
decision. So this may not just be an on-off switch. This
right.
may be looking into what the depth of the situation is in Texas. And is this inherently a mess?
Well, it's going. Here's what they're doing. It's going against the grain of how courts have been working recently, because we got this federal legislation that you've only got a year after your state conviction is final to file something in the federal court. Everybody's trying to cut off people's writ rights, and that's what seems to be the trend. In fact, when we passed our legislation, we were following the federal guidelines. We were cutting off the number of writs that were filed in federal court. And basically, it's going against the grain, and that may very well be what they're talking about, is that this is the only thing that could be done I can think of, is that they may be looking at that statute that says you can't file subsequent writs, and they may find a loophole in that. That's the only thing I can think of. That's the only decision that's come out. It came out the 31st, and that's about the only thing left to appeal.
the statute that Jim's talking about is the 1996 Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, which in effect shut the door on state prisoners, and that's what it was designed
to. Federal legislation.
Yeah, federal legislation that Bill Clinton signed in office in April of 1996, and that statute was designed to essentially, as Jim said, give you got your direct appeal, and after your direct appeal, you got one bite at the federal habeas apple. And in order to get that one bite at the federal habeas apple, you have to go through the state courts. You have to file a proper, timely post-conviction application in state courts. And if it's denied, then you got your one bite at the federal court. And once you go through the federal courts, all the way to the United States Supreme Court, there's no more bites at the apple. But that's a procedural issue that I would find hard to believe that at this late juncture in this case that the Supreme Court would be sitting up there delaying a case of this magnitude on a procedural technicality, whether or not they would want to say that the state's habeas provisions, as Jim referred to, are somehow unconstitutional. I think they would be hard-pressed to do that in light of the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act, which says essentially the same thing. That's what Texas patterned its statute on, which that one bite of the apple statute is based on the Anti-Terrorism Effective Death Penalty Act. And the Supreme Court has upheld that time and time again, as has the Fifth Circuit. So in this case, most time when you have a last-minute stay, it's going to go to the Supreme Court justice over whatever circuit the cases are, that would be the Fifth Circuit.
Who answered the telephone?
Yes, but I think in this case it would have been the justice who's over the Fifth Circuit who would have got the first phone call.
And that usually is Scalia.
And it's usually, and I don't know if Scalia is over the Fifth Circuit, but if he is, and he said, hold it, I'm going to deny this, and he still got to, I think, run that past rest of court. Am I correct in that, Jim?
Absolutely. It takes a vote at least four of them to get a stay granted. Sure, you can't. One person can't do it.
Really?
Unless they do like Keller and close the office.
Okay. Now, if you're going to deny the stay, it only takes one.
Yes.
But if there is the possibility of a stay, you go fish.
Yes.
That's fascinating. That's absolutely. In other words, it takes more energy to stop the train than it does to keep it going.
Yeah. You know what it reminds me, and this is one of those crazy, this is why death penalty stuff is so crazy. I remember when Ann Richard was governor, and she sent this real crazy memo to all the lawyers, and this is when they were trying to get some legislation passed to tell lawyers to quit filing writs. And what she said in the memo she sent to everybody, that people were suffering and languishing on death row, and they shouldn't be having to go into that suffering, but to go ahead and just kill them and get them out of their misery. And so they're wanting us to quit filing writs. That's when she was pushing to get legislation, is to cut off the number of writs, because they were languishing and suffering on death row. Well, I figured if they wanted to die, they could do that. Why would they file the writs?
I laughed. If it was on their behalf,
just nutty,
that they had control over. I want to tell those of you who are hanging on by your fingernails that Elizabeth, our producer, has actually called Gloria, and everything is just on standby up there. We have got about 7 minutes left in this program, and it is apparent to me that we're not going to be on the air if and when there's an execution. So what you need to do is you need to think about other sources of news to find out what happens to this waiting game. But I want you to think for just a minute about the Medellin family. Some of them are there. And I want you to think for just a minute about the Chi family. They are there with the demonstrators, and they have got the same thing coming up with someone they care about next Thursday. Now, the families didn't kill nobody. They weren't gangsters. They didn't rape and murder any teenage girls. But they don't know what the decision is going to be. Flashes back to what I said on the last program. This is a very slow, very deliberate, very ritualized killing. And everything is according to the same thing that happened the last time. And now we're into a delay sequence, which is an equally ritualistic part of the process. a few judges behind closed doors are mumbling at one another, maybe even arguing out loud, as to whether this man will live or die. Families are huddled somewhere in the walls who have came to witness them dying. And they don't know why they can't be satisfied by seeing them breathe their last breath. Because this is a state ritual. This is no less ritualized than the dragging someone to the top of the stairs of an Aztec temple and cutting out their beating heart and throwing it in their blood flowing down those stairs. This is a religious government ritual activity. And everybody, no matter what part they play, is hanging in suspense. Why? Because I think the state is trying to make it seem innocuous. The victims, survivors are trying to make it seem not easy for the person they're executing. And the executions, families, and supporters are trying to get someone they care about to survive the night. Human life is important to all of those people. Now, you can sort them out. This life is worth more than that life. I stopped doing that a long time ago. Because I know, as sure as I know who I am, I can walk out of here, get run over, and be dead in 15 minutes. Human life is very precious, but it's also very temporary. And we need to think very carefully about what we do to our society by taking it. Billy Sinclair is with us. He's been through this ritual from a different perspective than I have. Any thoughts, Billy?
The final thought is I truly understand the sentiments and feelings that the victims, family for going through, Mr. Ertman and Mr. Pena, they've made their feelings well known, and I understand, and I think everyone understands and appreciates their sentiment. But I think at the end of the day, when all is said and done, and if Medellin is executed, they will find that that revenge leaves a sour taste. There's no satisfaction in it. And at the end of the day, nothing will be gained and nothing will be accomplished with the execution of Jose Medellin.
Jim Skelton, any final arguments from your point?
No, I think he's all said it pretty well. And I remember years ago, Ray, he was talking about that. I knew a prosecutor that was really hard-nosed. And the reason he quit, he said it wasn't the fact that the people that he prosecuted were, he felt badly for them. He said, I got the tired looking in the faces of mothers and wives who did nothing wrong, who suffered. And I think that's an excellent point. And that's why he quit. He said, I just couldn't stand to look at another mother whose kid I put in the penitentiary. I don't feel badly about putting the kid in the pen, he said. I just couldn't stand to look at the mother's face and the wife's face because they did absolutely nothing. Now, in this case, apparently, Medellin, like most of them, had kind of a bad childhood. He was raised, I think, by some foster folks. I think then he went back to his family. I think his family pretty well abandoned him in this particular case.
Okay, Otis is going to figure out how to put some music in your ear, and we're going to go out with that. My name is Ray Hill. This is Texas Execution Watch on KPFT HD2.